officially sanctioned tolerance. Next week, I'll be in the very different world of Southern Europe to find out if some of these lessons can be applied to one of the continent's newest Muslim communities in Italy.
Yo, peace and love, and what up? It's homeboy Sandman, kicking in my people some free radio, Santa Cruz, 101.3. What happened?
Homie
tried to steal my shit. Yo, what's up with that?
This is a download from the BBC. You'll find more information at bbcworldservice.com.
At the top of a Milan apartment block, two young children play with their toys on a bare concrete floor. There's no room for them inside their home. The children's parents are young immigrants from Egypt, members of one of Europe's newest Muslim communities, and finding life hard.
Tell me about it. Would you say something to the...
No.
From BBC.
Two different levels. Of the puppets and of the puppet masters. The level more important is of the puppet master. If there isn't a puppet master, there is no terrorism. If there isn't somebody that has a plan, that has the money, that use the Islamic religion for his power, there will be no terrorism.
And in a Milan courtroom, I see where all this can lead. Closely guarded by a throng of armed policemen, a metal cage holds six young Muslim defendants. Addressing the court is Armando Spataro, one of Italy's top prosecutors specializing in counterterrorism. Later, during a break in the trial, he tells me what's going on.
This is a trial against six defendants. We discovered a group of people involved in activity to create false documents to help many people to go in Iraq and in training camp, also in Afghanistan. They spoke also very often on possible bomb in Italy, but fortunately they never realized their project.
Thanks to its geography and the fact that, by all accounts, it's a great place to get forged passports, Milan has become a magnet for extremists. But, says Armando Spataro, they can only function if the ties that bind Muslims to the wider society around them are weak.
The terrorist group don't want any integration. They refuse integration. But, in any case, it's important to help any possible integration, because in this way it's possible to help the moderate part of the Islamic community. We need their help, because it's difficult to think that we can win this crime only with police investigation, only with trial. We need also the help of the Islamic community.
So, how Italy helps its Muslims to integrate will be one of the factors influencing its security. Officials worry that the country won't just export violence, but itself become the target of some future attack, just as Spain was in 2004 and Britain a year later. Right now, the signs are that integration is proving to be a slow and halting process. So, what are the obstacles? I meet up again with Osama, the student I talked to earlier. He and some of his friends get together in a small Egyptian kebab house. While many of them are, like him, from Arab families, one is not. Habiba is a Muslim convert from Romania. European she may be, but as soon as she donned the headscarf, she was seen through different eyes.
I could notice the difference immediately. From behalf of my brothers and sisters, I got positive reaction because I made lots of friends, but the rest of the Italian people were very hostile. You can see the hostility in their eyes. And of course, watching TV, you can see what they say about us. the untruthfulness that they spread about us, and that it's, yes, that really makes me angry.
Habiba and her friends are painting a grim picture, a country where most Muslims are not citizens and so don't have political rights. It's a far cry from Northern Europe, where Muslims arrived decades earlier and have arguably put down deeper roots. But could the very newness of the problem here work to Italy's advantage? Could Italy learn the lessons of Britain, France and the Netherlands? Or are Muslims and non-Muslims destined to retreat into their respective corners? It's my last day in Milan, and I'm spending it with Osama as he tries to put his Muslim principles into practice, and often finding they come into collision with the world around him. So, Osama, this is a kindergarten where you come and work from time to time.
Yeah, I'm coming here from on Monday, one day a week, and I stay for an half a day.
Osama sees education as key to the well-being of immigrants like these, and especially to young Muslims. He has no problem with the Italian state schools, but he believes Muslims need more. In a world that can corrupt and deprave Islamic values, real education, he says, moral education, is in the home.
Every posters in the streets got a naked woman, so what they learn outside the house, forget it. The family educate, and the kid learn from the family, from the school, from the streets, from the work, from everything around him. So the family is not a problem. It's the kid when he found himself between all those things and don't know what is the real way.
It's this that makes Osama so different from his peers. And it's a theme which continues in the afternoon as we set off for his university. You've been studying just for a few months. This is your first year at the university. How do you find it?
I think that the university is the heart of the society. And I find it very, very, very interesting because they explain me how this society should be. Not how this society is, but how this study should be. And I find it very different how should it be.
In a packed lecture hall, today's topic is women's rights. Osama listens, making notes, then puts up his hand to ask a question.
Nei primi anni del 400 dopo Cristo, in Arabia, la donna ha incominciato, non ha incominciato.
Women's liberation began, he says, with the Prophet Muhammad. There's a gasp of disbelief at his intervention.
You intervene to say that the women in Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, were liberated. They were given more rights when the Prophet Muhammad came. It sounded as if the audience didn't really believe you.
Yes, just because they don't know nothing about Islam.
Why did you feel that you wanted to say something?
Just because they talk about the women, so they believe that the first society that that give rights to the women was the West, but in Arabia there was the women became equal to the men, the rights.
So you felt that she was leaving something out, she left out your part of the world?
Yes, the West has the influence of the Arabic history and the Islamic history. So the West had to recognize that.
There's no doubt about it. Osama keeps finding his own beliefs and values at odds with those of the society where he's been born and bred. He's no extremist, but he's resolute in his belief it's better to tread a lonely and righteous path than compromise on his convictions. He admires much of what the West has achieved, but sees it as a moral vacuum. And in this, Osama is not alone. Many young Muslims are like him, charting a course based on a new, idealized vision of Islam. You can admire their courage, and yet wonder where this uncompromising stance will lead. If this is integration, It's a very ambiguous integration.
God changed for him, wants to change.
I feel free, free from the slavery of this society. I am free to look at the world with new eyes.
In the end, is it possible to live the life of a good Muslim in a place like this?
Only if the people get out from this ignorance, because people don't know nothing about Islam, but they are too easy to judge me and judge my brother, my sister, and all the Muslims. The society don't help any Muslim to be a good Muslim. You have to be strong.
It's cold. Let's go to the metro.
As I prepare to leave Milan, I look back at my European journey. I'm struck by the diversity of what I've seen and heard. How to make sense of the experiences of young Muslims in four such different countries as Britain, France, the Netherlands and Italy. The common thread, I think, is the shared sense of alienation and exclusion which much of this new generation of Muslims seems to feel. The question is, how will this alienation be expressed? Some of the new generation, like the young rap musicians I met in Amsterdam, are embracing an essentially secular youth culture, even if Islam remains in some general way a badge of their identity. Others, like Osama, are taking the difficult path of the born-again Muslim, which inevitably sets them apart from their friends and from the wider society. The idea that integration is not happening at all and that Islam just won't fit into European society seems to me a myth. But integration is a slow and difficult process, and so far, no one country can claim to have got it right. What's clear is that if the process fails, the anger of a small but growing number of Europe's Muslims may turn to violence.
And you are tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org. If you want to get in touch with us, you can leave us a message on this website, or you can contact me by phone. I'll pass on the word to the larger collective, small as we are. My phone number is 831-423-4833. My name is Robert Norris, and you're about to hear my show, 2 hours of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, mostly interviews from the street and discussion of the homeless crisis that is now upon us, the crisis for homeless people, that is to say, not to be confused with the crisis of paranoia, which homelessness seems to provoke in the minds of those who just cannot get off the notion that their property values and their ability to live in a pristine middle-class environment is of the highest paramount importance, and more so than the human rights and the human welfare of all of us.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me laugh. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial, tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome to the March 23rd, 2017 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Be with you for 2 hours now from 6 to 8, but this is pre-recorded, so you can't reach me on the air, and you can't engage in direct dialogue, which I think is too bad. We are still looking for a studio, and you find us one, you get $500 if we can stay there for a year, or I think we prorate you if we can stay there for less. We'll pay for it, need 10 by 10 space, has to be accessible with both electricity, not that we want to be shocked to death, but we want power, and we also want to have access to the internet and somewhere to go poo-poo. So we can be inside or outside, we can build our own little shelter, actually. We've done that before at Free Radio, we're pretty creative, some of us anyway. I myself like to watch while others build, but I'm just letting you know we need an access to a studio to really continue even these canned shows. It's not really canned. I mean, this show is being recorded on the same day as it's going to be broadcast, and hopefully it's pretty up to date. But a lot of people don't do their shows because they don't have a studio to go to, and they don't have either you kind of lose motivation after a while. We need your support in the community if we're to continue. It really kind of may boil down to that. So support us. Get in touch. You don't have to do a lot. Ask around. See if you know of anybody who has a space in the cellar. It can be very modest. 10 by 10 isn't a lot of space. And then get in touch with us. Again, 423-4833 is my number. You can also call me at that number if you want to comment on this show, if you want to be on the air, if you want to be a free radio broadcaster or contribute something to free radio or make some suggestions about programming or for any reason whatsoever. And we will get back to you. So according to today's urinal, that is to say the Santa Cruz Sentinel as I describe it, their headline is Winter Shelters Sunset in April, Reduced Santa Cruz Sanctuary Options Spark Renewed Discussions. And that's an article by the inimitable Jessica A. York. Since she's written, I think she wrote a good article recently, or an article that was better, about the attempt to wall off the post office from the homeless masses, and to stop them from sleeping there when it was raining, which is what people are doing. They're going under the eaves of buildings rather than lie out on the sidewalk or try to hide in the bushes where the rangers are continuing to look for them or seem to be using a kind of a high-profile, get-out-of-town approach. But Jessica has written a story in today's paper that mentions that the winter shelter program, which has been run by the Association of Faith Communities this year because the Homeless Lack of Services Center refused to do it. I'm not sure whether that was good news or bad news, considering the track record of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. That's the Coral Street main homeless service provider, as they like to style themselves. And the shelters instead have been up at the Veterans of Foreign Wars post on 7th Avenue in Live Oak. And then the other one was at the Salvation Army, or still is, at Laurel Street. The veterans, according to this article, closes at the end of the month, and the Salvation Army shelter closes on April 7th. Which may be accurate. I mean, I don't know if Jessica should know, but she's probably asked, and that's probably what they told her. And I assume that's the case. There's also a plug for Paul Lee and Steve Plaich, two community activists who would like to see a year-round emergency shelter located at the Vets Memorial Building. And Plaich apparently has come up with rough parameters for a 35-day trial program with a $24,000 budget. And aimed at getting something, I'm quoting from the article, established prior to the existing winter shelter's closure. His proposed funding sources would be public-private partnerships, whatever the hell that means, and supplemental veteran services financial resources for 20 people. Maybe it means 20 and there'll be more on top of that, I don't know. I mean, my reaction to these shelter programs, though, I was a person who... Well, we risked jail to create the early interface satellite shelter program some decades ago here in Santa Cruz in order to make sure they picked people up in a stop that was out of the rain, in order to expand the what we call the mini river shelter. I was arrested for that on New Year's Eve in 1988-89, along with 8 or 9 other people demanding they open up the annex out there, and they did because it was embarrassing to them. They claimed they had to remodel it and it wouldn't be open till summer. Well, they opened it a week or two later, and that was good news for the, I don't know, dozen or so people that got in there. But I've grown either more grandiose or less patient over the years. I'm not sure which. But there are 1,000 to 2,000 people outside without shelter. And I've always raged that if you're not going to shelter them, don't arrest them, don't cite them, don't harass them if they're just sleeping and doing nothing else. And that one has not yet been able to touch the conscience or the intelligence of the city council, the city manager, the police force, or the Sentinel, or even the main service providers who, at least in the last decade or two, have been unwilling to come forward with the most obvious statements about the rights of human beings outside who have no options. Other than the most kind of mealy-mouthed, gee, we wish we could do more, gosh, it's a start sort of thing, which doesn't talk about the nightly seizure of homeless property, the driving of homeless people into the rain, the fact that homeless people die 20 years younger than the normal population. It's pretty grotesque what happens here in Santa Cruz. Not unusual, you know, across the country. It's a sort of standard in many... particularly tourist cities or large urban areas, but we live here and we let this shit happen, and it is our disgrace. So it's also my and your responsibility to try to do something about it. So anyway, Steve Plaich and Paul Lee are apparently trying to help 20 to 70 people. That's nice, out of 1,000 to 2,000 people. And it has to be said, both these men have in the past and currently oppose the city's absurd sleeping ban ordinance, which makes it a crime to sleep after 11 o'clock at night on any public property. And there's some people who just do not understand this, or else they certainly sound like they don't. I've been, in a foolish way, engaging in a written exchange of, it seems like insults mostly, so that's what's so foolish about it, with the people on the Sentinel Discus website. That's the comment section that you go to if you read an article in the Sentinel and you want to comment on it. You can try. I think they're now limiting the number of times you can read articles without actually subscribing to the online Sentinel. However, some people apparently seem to believe, and I guess it's hard to imagine this, but they don't want to acknowledge the sleeping ban exists. Or they'll say, well, we don't favor that, but we think the homeless people have got to clean up their behavior, and they're all coming to town, and they're ruining our culture, and they're clogging up our bathrooms, and you know, that kind of thing. You get this. Some of these comments are true. Well, obviously, what you need when these things happen is better social services. You know, I think you need more options. You need to stop funding wealthy developers and simply concentrating on how much money you can get from Airbnb and on what really is going to be a nightly reality because of the economic and social situation in Santa Cruz and elsewhere as well, of course. I mean, there's one guy who actually believes that to claim that it's a crime to sleep in Santa Cruz after 11 just isn't true, because you can always ask permission of a private person, or you can ask permission of the city council and the Parks and Rec, and maybe they'll give you permission. Of course, it can really, really pretty accurately be said that no such permission has been granted to any group of people for any length of time over the last 40 years in Santa Cruz. There have been some exceptions. A Russian delegation passing through town in the 80s got permission to camp out at Harvey West. There was a tolerated campground at the San Lorenzo Park area during the Occupy movement in the fall of 2011, but they didn't ask permission. They just went there and said, the Constitution is our permit. So it's really ignorant and foolish to claim that there's anything other than an anti-homeless law in Santa Cruz, as in other cities, but particularly in Santa Cruz. And it has to be drawn to our attention that it is here in Santa Cruz that this is happening, because this is where we are. So, the mini shelter program for the winter shelter, which has been housing 100, 110 people a night, if they can trek their asses out to the edge of town and then get bussed back into the Salvation Army or the other area on 7th Avenue, and then deal with the rules. You know, that becomes a big deal. Oh, these are homeless people, are rules resistant? No, it's simply that the rules, when you get treated like a 7-year-old in these shelters, and you also get bedding that some claim, for example, out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, where there, it isn't even a shelter anymore, but the Paul Lee Loft is the so-called transitional warehouse where people wait, giving their checks over to the Homeless Lack of Services Center, or having to have them in order to be there, while they're supposedly being lined up for housing that generally does not exist. The shelter conditions are pretty wretched. And that's why many people will choose, not because they love the homeless lifestyle, but because, first of all, they're human beings. They're not cattle, and they're not boxes of debris to be stored somewhere during the night and then shoved out in the morning. That kind of does not make for a happy situation. So, in any case, however, my point has always been, you don't arrest people for sleeping if they have no place to go, and the overwhelming majority of people in Santa Cruz who are outside have no place to go. That's on public property. Now, if some of the generous bigots on the Sentinel website want to offer their place, and I've got to say that the same individual who doesn't understand the notion of the sleeping ban being a law that makes it illegal to sleep outside on public property after 11, whether in a vehicle or on the ground or under a structure, illegal, subject to a $200 fine, wake-up call, confiscation of your property, all that sort of thing. This individual, and this is the irony, claims, and I don't think he's lying to me, he claims that he's putting up a homeless mother and child, something like to that effect, and I commend them for it. I think that's great. But at the same time, it's sort of like the guy who says, some of my best friends are Jews, or some of my best friends are Negroes. And what he really means is, don't call me a bigot because I can prove I'm not bigoted by this kind of demonstration. But in fact, it doesn't necessarily prove anything if you're supporting legislation and arousing people to somehow regard as criminals people whose real, quote, crime is surviving at night under a tent or under the eave of a building. And that's because that shows how illegal they are. That shows how disrespectful they are of the law. No. It shows they got the common sense not to respond like whipped dogs, because other people have decided that they're the slaveholders and everybody else who's lower in social status and who has been made a criminal by the nature of what the law itself states ridiculously and irrationally, has to obey or be punished. Anyway, people are fighting back now. People at City Hall, this is what I've heard for the last week, have been sleeping there every night. There used to be this, and still is, a Tuesday night freedom sleepout. Number 89 happened last Tuesday, and I guess number 90 is coming up on next Tuesday on the 21st. No, I'm a little behind the times. It's the 28th. The fact that people are now refusing to, well, gathering anyway, even without the guidance of a few longly persistent freedom sleeper leaders who are mostly housed. There was a larger group of us, and I was part of that group, and I'm still a sympathizer and a supporter, and I write about it and I talk about it on the air, but I don't sleep out there at night. There are only a few who do, who are housed and do so regularly, and they also help supply food from Food Not Bombs and from Joe Schultz's India Joe's Kitchen and from donations from other individuals. There are sympathetic individuals in the community who help feed this every Tuesday night, this event. But now it's happening every night. Not that I'm not aware that there's a lot of food showing up, and Food Not Bombs people have got their hands full struggling with their own Saturday and Sunday meals that happen every weekend at the outside the main post office's forbidden fence. You may be familiar with that one. Regular listeners or people who try to mail a letter or go get something to eat on Saturday or Sunday. At 3 o'clock, there is still the weekly or twice weekly decorate the fence party, which happens right before the Food Not Bombs meal, where people are encouraged to bring their decorations down and decorate the fine anti-homeless architectural fence that is now walling off the post office. The claim, by the way, by post office officials, and you're going to hear this in one of these interviews, is that they are trying to do construction, and the fence is simply there to protect the community and the people. Or, of course, the article in the paper by Jessica York claimed that no, it really has to do with poo-poo and pee-pee and needles, you know, the stuff that Pamela Comstock, former city council member, and Hillary Bryant and Ken Robinson rose to power on. The Take Back Santa Cruz mantra. Kind of an old story. I heard it 25 years ago from KSCO right-wingers that the homeless are skunks, punks, and drunks. That's pretty much the story that these lower-class people. And it's an old story, and I think the same mythology arises in a lot of different societies, Western societies, particularly throughout history. It is at the City Hall. Homeless people are taking things into their own hands, and they're showing up in numbers, 10 or 20 a night, sleeping out at City Hall. And there is some conflict in the groups. There's some problems. I go down there and I record their experiences there, the accounts I get, and you're going to hear some of those today and more on Sunday, assuming I get to do that show, which is a morning show from 9:30 to 1 or 2 or later. But the fact is that people are beginning to say, we have a right to live. We have a right to not be harassed by the police if we're sleeping. We have the right not to have our property stolen. Now, it seems pretty self-evident to me that this is a positive thing. But if they're going to get assaulted for asserting that right by the police, I don't see good things coming out of this situation. Well, I'm a middle-class guy, and the prospect of violence or forceful resistance makes me anxious. I've never really had to do it, or if I have had that choice, I've made other choices in my life. And so all I can say is that My sympathies are with those who are getting tromped on, not those with the boots. Whatever kinds of fancy excuses that they have for doing it, or pretty laws they put forward to justify their behavior. Let's have a musical break. I'll be back, and you'll hear some voices other than mine. Well, that didn't go well. Let's try another one from David Robicks. This one is called John Brown. And he describes a bit of what this song is about, and I may mention a bit afterward.
The Fugitive Slave Act had just been passed in 1850, and that basically brought slavery into the living rooms of people in the North for the first time in a big way. Because no longer was the North a safe place for escaped slaves to have some semblance of freedom, it was now they had to go to Canada. So that's when the Underground Railroad started taking people mostly to Canada. There was lots of people on both sides of the issue, and then among the abolitionists, they could be said to fall into the basic categories of those who believed in a sort of civil disobedience, nonviolent struggle, and those who believed in doing whatever seemed appropriate. And then there were a lot of people, it seems like, who sort of publicly advocated one position and then privately were buying guns. So it's kind of, the lines were really blurry. But those ranks, both sides included lots of ministers. And there was one minister named Beecher. Beecher related to Harriet Beecher Stowe. He was sending rifles out to the abolitionists in Kansas, and they were much sought after rifles, but these rifles were Sharps rifles, which was a new development in rifle technology, I understand, at the time, because they could actually hit the target, which is kind of a new idea. Bad idea, really, but once somebody had it was like a Sharps armed rifle race. The rifles shipped out by Beecher, they became known. He would ship them out in big crates and marked on the side of the crates with Bibles, and good way to get them to Kansas. And then they became known as Beecher's Bibles.
John was Owen's son. He grew up in New England. He was born in Torrington. John Brown was a tanner and a man of many skills. He stood up for the workers who toiled in the mills. He stood up for the Indians. He stood up for the women, for the oppressed and the exploited. This good man stood with them. So when Kansas was bleeding, he went and joined the fray. The slave trade wanted Kansas. The slave trade would have to pay. Riding on the Kansas prairie, fine and loyal band. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. With 2,000 of New England's best and bravest sons, Captain Brown fought in Kansas with a Bible and a gun. When Free Lawrence was on fire, lighting up the night, the border ruffians would flee. John Brown would stand and fight. Lincoln called him a fanatic, and he was a Christian who thought you should do unto others as you'd have others do unto you. Christ said, love your neighbors, and if your neighbors held in slavery, he was one who felt his duty was to fight to set them free. Riding on the Kansas prairie, with a fine and loyal band. Glory, hallelujah. bordering misery. Raided the plantations, no compromising. Broke the chains and shackles, rode at night to Canada. Out of this nightmare, the devil's home, America. He was caught in Harper's Ferry, his family lying dead. They questioned him for hours as he lay there and bled. They hanged him on the gallows, they laid him in his grave. John Brown was a Christian, and he died to free the slave. Riding on the Kansas River, when a fine and loyal band. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand.
So this is a dialogue on March 15th, the day after about 88, which is about a week and a half ago. Keith McHenry was tabling at the post office in order to encourage people to protest the fence around the post office. He was signing up people for a petition and letters to the postmaster or postcards.
It's going to come out of our pocket if they get
hurt. So we're here at the post office here, and we're listening to a dialogue between an employee of the post office and Keith McHenry, who has a table in front of the post office here today.
If you have it on record, that's true. But I hate to tell you, I don't know why they're pushing it, and it's probably.
And she's telling us that this is actually, these fences are put up in order to paint the post office, but it doesn't. It's not, of course, what the Sentinel says.
No, if he has it on record and it's his name,
yeah, it's
true.
There.
But I'm just trying to think, if it's his name.
Well, no, it's in all the papers. Yeah.
I don't know.
They're lying. Now we got to get the straight dope here. So you.
All I know is that they already asked for the money to paint. And they approved it. It's going to take maybe a month or two. But my understanding is some homeless were in this area, and they were worried about them falling. So what they did was they pushed the gate like this further. It's not anti-anything.
You know what
my understanding
about this?
So I don't know.
The homeless don't have a place to pee or to go to the bathroom.
I know.
If they would put, why don't we do something about that?
Yeah, if they would put some areas, good bathrooms for every, not just homeless, for everybody. No, for everybody. Not just
for everybody.
See, you're just doing for the homeless. It's not, that's not right. It's everyone. Even for me, when I can't find a bathroom in this area, when I'm eating.
We have a lot of tourists.
Yes. We don't know. And if you would put like bathrooms in areas, but also we have to have someone to try to educate. And it has nothing to do about cleanliness or anything, but to tell the homeless, you know, to keep this thing, we have to do this, this, and this, A, B, and C. And if we follow A, B, and C, and we force the other ones, or if I'm homeless, I would say, please, to make it okay for everybody, please do this and this and clean up after you. I think it would be nicer, and everybody would be okay with it. But, you know, it's kind of hard. Even me, I'm having...
And this is the oft-heard comment that if, you know, a rotten apple is ruining it for the whole barrel. If only these Negroes acted more nicely, people would not treat them like they were second-class citizens. Unfortunately, this is really a form of rationalization of internal prejudice and paranoia. That is my general belief. It is true. You'll get bad behavior from numerous folks. It's also true that middle-class people expecting middle-class behavior from people who have to spend every night outside is preposterous. And it becomes a form of vicious cruelty when it is enforced with legislation. Like, oh, we won't let you sleep here unless you follow the following 43 rules. And rules that may seem reasonable to a person who is inside a building who is able to dress and shower and eat and close a door behind them every night, but actually is not the case for people who are outside. And the idea of seeing people visibly outside, it shocks people, it frightens people, it makes them feel sympathy and a desire to help, and at the same time makes them suspicious that they're being manipulated. There's a whole, at least this is what I find in myself when all these things happen, and maybe I'm not typical, but I think these things happen generally. Let's hear some more of this discussion.
What about in the wintertime when the weather is so bad? Is it possible to use the vets' facilities for what you do?
I don't know.
It's possible, but they don't let us do it.
Why not?
Why?
You got to ask them. Keith, have you heard any specific response?
Well, the thing is that our goal is to change society so that no one has to live outside or eat at soup kitchens. If you're indoors doing that, no one will ever walk by and talk to you. You will be just hidden. And so if we are over here,
it's visible.
That way then there will be a public dialogue about. Otherwise, you get more and more home.
Afterwards is all the trash and stuff, which doesn't help you.
But the reality is that there is no trash left behind.
Yeah. I live here. I see it.
You can see it right here. Because every single time we share food, we go through this whole place. Look at all the trash right now.
But after you leave, there's still people here with trash.
Well, we go and we collect all the trash.
I know you try.
And then if you notice there's the trash right now, and you notice a lot of times the trash, right?
Yes.
And you also know that no one shops on Pacific Avenue because of the homeless, right?
What? I don't know.
That's another thing.
I see a lot of people.
We've understood that the trash is here. But the reality is the trash has got nothing to do with the homeless. I mean, some of it might be people that came to eat, but a lot of it is just people that...
Dialogue continues.
Tell everybody to stop selling coffee and juices in the
downtown.
We need
a place where the homeless can put their stuff.
But what they've done is made it illegal for them to put their stuff in. So, like, all the bicycle places for, like, very almost no money, you can open them up and put your belongings in. But if they see that the belongings are in there that are not a bicycle, then they come and they take it and throw it away.
And Keith is talking about the bike lockers that you find in some of the parking garages and that are near the library, which... they do not allow you to place stuff in other than bicycles, because homeless people were not only placing stuff in them, on occasion they were living in them, trying to shelter themselves, but at least to store their property there. And that was considered to be inappropriate, you see. And it's another example of kind of the cutoff line. How do I put it? If people have other places to store their property, and bicycle lockers are made to serve people with bicycles, it's not unreasonable to suggest, well, put your bikes in there, but put your property somewhere else. But if there's nowhere else to do it, then to suddenly say, aha, you're not putting your bikes in there, you're putting your property in there, that's wrong, we're excluding you, is itself a form of blindness and, I think, of course, cruelty toward people who need some place to store their property during the day, as all of us know, or should know, but perhaps we've forgotten because it became sort of second nature to us if you live indoors somewhere.
Why can't you make it legal to have belongings that are not a bicycle?
Well,
what does the city
do? Well, because then helping the homeless...
Don't we
want to
help?
No, we want them to die and leave town.
No.
That's what I think.
No.
No, because
that's his thoughts. Don't sell the
book. Well, no, I'm not. No,
but a lot of people who want to get rid of them.
Yeah, that's why we can't get the laws changed here. We tried to get it so that you are allowed to sleep outside without a blanket and without a sleeping bag.
So where do they sleep now? I know about ladies.
It's illegal to sleep everywhere that they're sleeping.
But where do they? I mean, you.
Now, Keith's reference to without a blanket and without a sleeping bag refers to the original proposal made by Don Lane in the spring of last year, when he finally, after 27 or 28 odd years of presenting himself as some champion of the homeless, came around to the view and publicly supported the idea that the sleeping ban itself was wrong and had to be changed. But because he didn't really want to go too far, he did what essentially Tim Fitzmaurice did 20 years ago, another council member, a very articulate, poetic sort of fellow, who was a part of the Green Reform Movement. He was a Green Party member. He actually became mayor around in 2001 for that year on the city council. And he, along with others, finally proposed a measure that the sleeping ban be eliminated, but only in certain areas and only if you slept outside without bedding and without a sleeping bag and without a blanket. I know, that sounds absurd. But I guess the theory was you didn't want to encourage people to sleep outside, and you wanted to somehow pass a measure that people would support without feeling that they were inviting an onslaught of homeless people to rush to Santa Cruz to take advantage of the wonderful prospect of sleeping on concrete on the sidewalk at night. Because if you can have a sleeping bag, well, I mean, that could make it terribly comfortable, right? I don't want to necessarily attribute that directly to Tim Fitzmaurice or to Don Lane, although those were the proposals that they initially pushed. It was actually modified at City Council before it was voted down 5-2, and nothing more was ever heard about it from those politicians. And those politicians never showed up at the Freedom Sleepers Sleep Out as protesters, and never came up with any kind of subsequent statements suggesting further avenues of support for the most basic human rights issues for homeless people outside, the right to survive without being harassed by the police department if they have no other options.
I come around 8:30 at night, and I walk around, and there's that poor woman who's a hefty one, got all her possessions.
Right.
Where does she go?
She just actually sleeps on that shit on the bench where you see her. No, it's illegal.
But they don't arrest her.
These people do get arrested. Have you ever been bothered by the police?
I've been asked to move along.
Yeah.
But I've never been given a ticket or anything.
Some people get 100 tickets for sleeping. And then we used to have the River Street the emergency shelter, but that got cut down.
You know, it takes money, and nobody wants to put money in it.
And, you know, Robert and I were here in the 80s going, why don't we have affordable housing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we would go to city council and say, like, why don't we start investing in
affordable housing?
It's a six-story building that's $6 million.
And actually, my position, although I'm a fan of affordable housing and a minimum, guaranteed minimum income, and probably far more than that, was when I was organizing in Santa Cruz in the late 80s, simply stop busting people for sleeping until there are legal places for them to go. And it was a relatively straightforward proposition, made, you know, to me, eminent sense. I think it garnered significant support, but among those who were in power, it didn't. Now, you know, why is that? Well, aren't these wonderful Democrats? Aren't these great progressives? And the answer is, it's a class issue. These are people concerned with their class interests. Their property is worth a certain amount of money. Their neighbors' opinions for those who live on the west side is worth something, too. They want to make sure they stay in office with votes that if they start supporting the rights of lower-income people, they're going to be suddenly arrayed against more massive financial forces that are opposing them. And that really was, I think, the reason that you didn't get that you haven't gotten a saner position from people on the Santa Cruz City Council who claim to be progressives. And when the progressives in Santa Cruz were in power from the mid-80s until at least about 10 years ago. So, and during that time, they took no action to meaningfully change the sleeping ban law. And it's partially it has to do also with the power of the police department and the power of those who support the police department, which has become more powerful, unfortunately, rather than less in the last decade.
The mental thing, because I hear them sounding, so they need help, these guys.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan closed all
there's an interesting story about that. That was actually a law passed by John F. Kennedy, right?
No, this was Ronald Reagan when he was governor.
Well, this is how it worked. Kennedy's sister was in a really terrible place in Massachusetts. Helped with the people there, and it was horrible. And he wanted to have halfway houses, but to win the vote, he had to have support of the states' rights and stuff. So then, you're right. Reagan was supposed to take the federal money and spend it on halfway houses
and local people,
and they never did that anywhere in the United States. Basically, they essentially just.
Yeah.
So Reagan is the most famous for that, but almost every state actually never. And then Kennedy got killed before he could lobby for the rest of that.
You know, I'm not really sure if that is either a complete or a completely accurate accounting of the famous tale of how there was a lot of deinstitutionalization. People had been held in miserable conditions and warehoused asylums, in essence, were released. That requires a whole show and probably some more research on my part about who did what when. I've done a lot of partial research on that throughout the last few decades, but we need to actually get into that issue more clearly to understand the history and also to understand the dangers of the stigmatizing of people with mental health, so-called mental illness conditions, as well as where mental illness is becoming defined as you're not taking your meds and a doctor has told you to, as though that's some sort of cure for what your condition is. And in fact, I've had numerous shows with writer and researcher Robert Whitaker in the past, in which he presents persuasive evidence, really unrefuted evidence, that those folks who are chronically using psychiatric medications have a less chance of long-term recuperation than those who actually never had the medications at all or who had them and then gradually came off of them. And there have been studies done by the World Health Organization about the situation in different countries as well. I've never heard a persuasive rebutting of the data he's presented, but it is so ingrained in us and the institutional psychiatry that is considered to be the highest wisdom in our society, and Western society, a lot of it anyway, at least among mainstream groups, that it's kind of become a matter of, yeah, we know the Earth is flat. I mean, the king has said so. I mean, it's clear you're going to sail off the edge of the world. In other words, if it is accepted and repeated over and over again, we have to be in Iraq. We've got to go in there and fight in Syria. It's really important to be doing that bombing in Somalia and Sudan and Yemen and Afghanistan because, well, I mean, Bush may have started it and Obama may have escalated it, but now we're there and we've, you know, that sort of thing. There's a whole series. I regard all of these things as myths, which have become sort of common wisdom when it's actually common mythology, and I think common foolishness.
Every state actually never, and then Kennedy got killed before he could lobby for the rest of that.
And the thing is, we're such a rich country.
Yeah.
And we're a really rich town. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Google could spend like one fraction of one penny percentage of their total profit.
So where's their social conscience?
Like a huge giant.
See that empty lot over there?
Yeah, the old bookstore.
All right, well.
You're going to change all this.
Yeah, you're going to join us, right? And then you can fill out a postcard and put it in here. And people are writing postcards to the postmaster, which we will then.
Well, you know, I really don't know where I stand with your thing because I don't know of any improvement in health with what you've done.
There's from the beginning. There's these people that have no food otherwise.
And they could
go to bed feeling like they had something to eat.
If they had a bed to go to,
we all wish we had a bed to go to.
Yeah.
I'm staying at the Salvation Army right now, and I had a stroke a week ago, and they threatened to throw me out last night that I was stomping around, and I can barely move my feet.
You know what? There's a lot of homeless now in front of City Hall. Have you noticed?
I've noticed because I camp out there.
Why did the city fathers see this? It's right there.
That's why we're there.
They can't see it.
Well, they see it, but they just think the people should just go away.
Yeah.
So, Sherry, you have an idea of starting a protest on April 7th when the winter program closes. There'll be another 100 people out on the street.
Yeah.
And I suggest that she talk to you about
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Well, all right. Well, come every Tuesday to the city hall.
And how old
we
is that baby?
We give out free meal and we all sleep out there.
And this proposal that there be a protest beginning April 7th when the second of the two winter shelter programs closes, which Sherry, who's a disabled woman of about 70 or more in a wheelchair, who was speaking to Keith and myself, and I guess the postal employee woman who came and went in front of the post office. She also showed up at the last two Huff meetings and brought a friend with her, and they're concerned about having, if not just a protest, establishing a place for people to go once the armory closes down. Or I should say the armory. It's no longer the armory. It's these two places that people have been using as winter shelter. So that's a... It's a hot issue that not just activists who are in their warm houses like myself are talking about, but it's also quite understandably in the minds of folks who are going to be severely impacted by the shutting down of the shelter. And these are the folks who will make the decisions once the shelter shuts down, where they will go, and with the police, when the police come, whether they will keep coming back, whether they will deal with those issues or how they will deal with those issues. And there are different kinds of strategies that have been used in the past. The future is unknown. We'll see what happens.
Well, here, this is a guy to talk to. You have a potential victim.
I just wanted to get involved with Food Not Mom.
Oh, perfect, yeah. We cook at India Joe's every Saturday and Sunday at noon.
Okay.
And if you want, you can sign up and get our email.
Great.
And then we come
down
here at about 3:30, we set up and we serve at 4 Saturdays and Sundays. That's a lot of fun.
Cool, thanks.
No, that's particularly cute.
My kid's cute.
Okay,
well, you're clearly a Marxist here.
Thanks.
Well, thank you. more of a grouch show. This is about the homeless civil rights group you're interested in. This,
okay.
This is on the radio. We do a radio show.
So, the homeless people are upset because they used to stay there, right?
Yeah, particularly in the rain. Everyone, there was like 30 people up there when it rained. And then when it rained, that's where we share the meal, is up there. And,
but it says construction area.
It's not really that. And what we, according to the newspaper yesterday, the post office says they're going to, we're just going to be here until they can make a more permanent
this is the specifics on his approach, his beliefs about it.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
It's demented, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they, you know,
I get it. I guess that they don't want everyone hanging out. You know, it's the post office.
Yeah, but the reality is that the people mostly hang out once it's closed. In my
right. No, that's true. There's not really people here.
And the last time she was here, I mean, some guy with Tourette's was cussing her out. She's carrying the baby.
Yeah.
If I had been here, I probably would have done something I shouldn't have done.
Right.
You know, and it's like,
so there's
I believe in the commons. We need to have the commons. But that's also bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, the
what's
one guy
threatened
that guy did that.
Oh, right.
Like, you know.
Yeah, when it becomes threatening, like, the guy was just walking around and he was, like, screaming things. And then, and I saw him and I kind of, like, I had a baby, so I'm, like, kind of trying to avoid him. And then he, like, right when he was walking by, he had already looked me in the eye. And so then he looked me in the eye again.
Oh, it's weird. We have Julie, who is a friend of ours. He's the most vulgar, horrible. Oh my God! But she's never that way with me anymore. But to our volunteers, you go,
you're just looking at me. I think I've seen her too around here.
Well, and she's got the the dog, and she just she always has a big heart and a really beautiful pit bull.
Oh, she's good.
And good.
Oh yeah, she's
and
pretty
horrible
now.
And but the worst now.
Oh,
but once
she says such sweet things to me whenever I see her.
Yeah, and then sometimes right now for like the last like 6 months, I've been having these amazingly complex, lucid, totally normal conversations with her. But then she'll turn from me and she'll just start swearing at somebody like, you're just trying to break. And it's like, what? Someone and you're just like, oh my God. And then she's back to me like, yeah, you know, when I went to Harvard, it was like this, you know. So she's like, actually, whatever. I don't know. You're just like,
oh my
whoa,
God.
You know about like quantum physics? And you're like yelling obscenities at these poor people.
Whoa, that's
and
crazy.
It's really
wow.
Like a weird thing. And then Tony, Tony might be the guy that's threatening.
I'm Robert, by the way.
I don't know. He lives here?
You walk down the street.
Yeah, but these are like, they're actually just people lost it. But Tony was treating me, he was threatening to kill me for like days. And then I'm like, what's up, Tony, man? Are you doing better today? And he like starts talking to me and tells me his whole life story. And he's completely lucid. And before that, I would have never known he could even have a normal conversation. And now he and I are best buddies, you know.
And what's
and
the name of this young baby?
Probably
it's Orion.
Ryan.
Ryan.
Yeah.
Like the constellation.
He was angry that they stole all his blankets and stuff. And then once he calmed down and I started always talking to him, and he just went back, he just started going, you know, I own the contracting company. And I used to build all these huge buildings and he was seriously.
How did it become? Like, I always
want
to know the story.
Well, in his case, he ended up, the IRS eventually took his business, or he lost all his money, and his wife flipped out when he went bankrupt and left him. And then he actually regrouped. That was like in 97 or something, and then he got it together by 2003, and he started another contracting business, and he actually was building some more buildings. It was like another, I don't know how big by that time what super buildings were, but then the IRS seized his property again, and then that was the end of it. Now he's living out. So another point of mine
in San Francisco was the president of a small oil company in Houston.
And what Keith is telling, and it's kind of hard to hear because of all the traffic noise, is a series of stories of people that he's run into who seem outrageous in their behavior at times and their language, because this is what this couple with the baby came up and complained about, that, you know, they're concerned about there should be a commons and there should be people should be allowed to sleep somewhere. I'm not perhaps quoting them accurately, but there's a general sympathy. But there's also this sense of apprehension and anger that the next minute someone could turn to you and start denouncing you and saying fuck you and so forth. And unfortunately, the recording is not very good, but I wanted to catch some of Keith's narrative about his experiences with the people who initially were very abusive to him and then became helpful at Food Not Bombs and revealed their rather educated, if you find that to be of value, background and so forth. Unfortunately, we're going to have to skip a lot of this because it's bad radio, and I kind of apologize for making you sit through it if you did, but that was the reason.
Antonio, and we've been listening to Keith McKenna of March 2017.
You know what?
So I'm outside the vet's hall. It's Vet's Service Day. Wednesdays, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. There's meal service at noon, medical outreach, harm reduction, housing services, jobs. I heard there actually have been some actual positive services here. And anyway, a man with a dog and a cart, and he himself is in a wheelchair. How's it going, man?
All right.
How are the vets treating you?
Okay.
You got groceries.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say for free radio?
Not very.
Okay. No problem, man. Well, right on. Got Cherie into the vet's hall, although maybe she could have walked in herself without any problem, but...
And Cherie is the woman, one of the women who was having a conversation earlier, a woman who is concerned if what's going to happen when the winter shelter program closes. She's been a user of it, and she wants to see some kind of either protest or additional area where people can camp or go. And she also, she turned and had to discontinue the conversation because she needed to go use a restroom, which in the nearest one was some distance away. Of course, there are plenty of restrooms in the area, but they don't allow, first of all, she's disabled and in a wheelchair. She has a wheelchair with her, but she's also kind of hobbling and walking as she goes. I asked a man coming out of the vet's hall if they would escort her in, and he kind of looked me up and down and then finally agreed, and apparently the vet's hall let her use the restroom. That was an issue that I used to raise, a decade ago when the vet's hall was a much more open place, and some of the managers wanted to keep out homeless people from using the bathrooms or even just the general public from using the bathrooms. And there were others in the vet's hall who felt differently, were happy to have people come in and use the bathroom as long as they didn't misuse the bathroom. And now, of course, I don't think the vet's hall is... I don't consider it to be a place where people who are just ordinary non-vets can go and use the bathroom, even though it's a pretty big, spacious bathroom on the first floor of the building. I think it's disabled, accessible. Who knows? Maybe there was county money that went into it. I don't know about that. And it's now, of course, considered as the site I mentioned earlier in the broadcast that Steve Plaich, who's with the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, I should say, is the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, and so describes himself, as well as Paul Lee, who's a regular, if not speaker, supporter of the Penny University, as it's, I think it's still called that. It happens every Monday night right next to the Calvary Episcopal Church homeless meal or coffee house meal. and usually has about 10 or 20 people attending it, some speakers from the left usually coming and chatting. Anyway, they want, as I mentioned before, to Lee and Plate, you're talking about setting up some kind of small shelter program once the main program closes down at the end of this month and in the beginning of April. And in a way, it's sort of a strategic decision, which it's the strategic time to propose it, because given particularly the kinds of protests that have been going on, which neither of them have given a lot of support to. Steve has been putting up weekly Facebook photos about the protests, and good for him. Just as I've been occasionally doing, well, every week I was doing an account of the protest, or a calendar announcement about the protest. That's now been taken over by Keith. And, of course, that's a great idea for those people who are vulnerable and in the program and are going to be even more vulnerable on the streets. But, of course, much more is needed, in the sense that you need to support people who are going to be and are currently gathering on the streets in encampments of their own, as is happening in all the major cities up and down the coast. And some of the things that have been proposed are clean and sober campgrounds along the lines of First They Came for the Homeless, or Brent Adams' proposed Sanctuary Village, or just support for encampments as they are existing up in Oakland, which has got some funding from the city supposedly till the end of March, but maybe, or maybe it was the beginning of March, I'm not sure, but it's probably still there under the freeway. And my claim has always been that, you know, there should be simply a private effort or a public effort to provide porta-potties, garbage bags, trash pickups, and the city should be funding this, for homeless encampments, because that's where people are living, and that's the reality of it. And it's a matter of public health and safety to do that. Not to mention, I mean, you can say compassion all you want, but it's just a matter of common sense. And simply proposing a small program for, I don't know, 30 or 40 people. I'm not sure if it's 20 or 70. It's a small program, because you might get somewhere, because there'll be pressure on the city at this point to do it. I understand the practical reasons to propose it at this time, because, hey, they're coming out of their shelter, and look, you don't want them to join all those protesters at City Hall, do you? Now's a good time to get some shelter for them, and I, you know, agree, but it's kind of along the lines of let's get rid of the protest by buying off the leaders, let's stop the protest movement by doing a so-called cleanup, but at the same time insisting we're providing social services for them, but only for a very, very limited period of time, but enough to catch the public's attention while they're watching, and soon they'll turn away and we can just ignore them and dump them wherever they happen to be and drive them out in the usual manner, although the usual manner does not seem to be working too well.
Hard to tell. Yeah, this kindly vet did take her in.
Campground that's safe.
Yeah, or any kind of. Yeah, or just like make it so.
There's so many empty buildings too.
Free radio here.
Oh, am I talking on the radio?
If you want.
Bring back Church and Stuff Genius. That's what I think.
Any building will do.
Yeah, there's a lot of empty buildings.
Yeah. What about 75 River Street?
That's Wells Fargo.
What's happening there?
It's fenced off, and homeless people sleep on the outside, and you know, it's sometimes. I haven't seen it much recently. And so you're a local. You've been around for a while.
I've been here since 71.
And what's your first name?
Alma.
And Alma, what changes have you seen that you want to talk about?
I hate that sculpture.
You're talking about the weird dinosaur across the street, yeah.
You know, I like the timeless quality, and that just looks like a toy, an ugly toy.
The Museum of Modern Art just showed up.
If it was a giant, I'd step on it.
Oh. You don't like this fence either, I think.
Oh, it's ugly.
Oh, yeah.
It's ugly. I know it's important, but there's... There's just not enough care for the homeless.
But it was important for. Not, I don't see any construction. That it's been up for 5 days now, I think.
There's my ride.
You take care, Elma.
Thank you.
All right. Anything you wish to say for free radio?
I need to say.
Okay.
And the fence has now been up for what? That was... So now it's been almost 2 weeks the fence has been up. I think it was put up 2 weeks ago tomorrow. You're tuned to Free Radio. That is to say, the stream of Free Radio at freakradio.org. My name is Robert, and this will be the second half of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, twice-weekly show coming up. If you want to catch me off air, give me a call at 423-4833. If you have news tidbits or some reflections on what you've heard or some disagreements with what you've heard or some new information, please give me a call, 423-4833. Hope Dies Last by Ryan Harvey.
So it's about 1:15 on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, for those of you who believe in green things. Also the anniversary of the Kronstadt Rebellion. However, that's another story. I'm talking here in front of City Hall with...
Dreamcatcher.
And Dreamcatcher is here, as I understand, hoping to talk to Martine Bernal, the actual real power of the city, or the shitty manager, as I like to call him. A number of us came, well, I came down, and others apparently, too, to talk to. Councilwoman Sandy Brown, who is reportedly ill and so not making it in. But Dreamcatcher is a problem because many weeks ago, I don't know, how many weeks now do you know?
Four.
And before we hear more of the specifics of Dreamcatcher's dilemma, which may have been resolved, actually, I want to point out that Sandy Brown supposedly or reportedly has office hours from 1 to 3 on Fridays. So since the show is going out on Thursday night, if you want to visit Councilwoman Sandy Brown, you can presumably just show up at 1 o'clock, as I did. Of course, I did that only to find that I was told she was ill. And though she knew I was coming because I'd emailed her, I got no response suggesting don't show up because I'm not going to be there. That likewise was a problem for activists Pat Colby and Dreamcatcher, who also wanted to chat with Councilwoman Sandy Brown. I usually hold council members running on a platform of alleged progressive goals like rent control and basic human rights for homeless people, which I think was one of the planks of Brown's platform. She ran with three other people, two of whom got elected, she and Chris Crone, two of whom didn't, Drew Glover and Steve Schnarr. But I expect progressives to, probably rather naive of me, obviously rather naive of me, to keep their word, or at least I guess I feel more justified in denouncing them when they don't. Perhaps that's because the people I know and have, and to some extent, either been working with or are friends with or just have a lot of interaction with or some interaction with have certain expectations of them. And when these expectations are not fulfilled, that is to say when they break their word, then it's important that we hold them accountable if our political movement, our movement for human rights, is to mean anything. And not to pretend that, oh, we just have to wait another year, another 5 years, another 10 years, whatever. So anyway, Sandy Brown, 1 to 3, Fridays, supposedly. You can also call the City Council offices at 420-5020, which I think I'm going to do to try to, I may arrange another appointment or just clarify for all of you out there if, in fact, she is going to be available tomorrow at that time. Let's see if we can do that and see if we can get a hold of her. But we're dialing now. The City Council 420-5020 number.
Thank you for calling the City of Santa Cruz offices of the City Manager, City Clerk, and City Council. Please hold while we transfer your call. Thank you for calling the City of Santa Cruz. How may I direct your call?
Looking for Sandy Brown.
Okay, just one moment, please. She's not in the office, but I'm very happy to put you through to her voicemail.
Do that, please.
Okay, just one moment, please.
Voicemail for Councilmember Sandy Brown. I'm sorry I couldn't take your call directly, but I will get back to you as soon as possible. Please just leave me a message and your phone number. Thank you.
Record your message at the tone. When you are finished, hang up or press pound for more options.
Hi, Sandy. This is Robert Norris calling you on Thursday. You may recall that we had a meeting kind of scheduled for last Friday. And then I understand you were ill. There are a couple other people who wanted to come. I think I let you know about this in several emails and also sent you some requests that, you know, you let me know if I'm barking up the wrong tree, if you're interested and so forth. Haven't heard from you. So please at least do me the courtesy of an email back or a phone call. I'm at 420-5... I'm sorry, I'm at 423-4833. You're at 420. 423-4833, or give me an email at rnorris3@hotmail.com to let me know whether you will be, in fact, available from 1 to 3 tomorrow, and if not, when you will be. I'm putting this out on free radio so that other folks can be best advised as to how to reach a city council member like yourself. Thanks. Now, I don't want to give anybody the misimpression. I'm now no longer talking to Sandy Brown, but just generally to you folks out there. I don't want to give anybody the misimpression that actually contacting city council members is likely to lead you anywhere. But it may be an important part of a broader movement that where you're showing that you are, in fact, a reasonable person trying to pursue established methods of communication, but apparently not getting anywhere, so that you need to take the next step. Next steps are things like showing up with massive numbers of people at public meetings, even city council meetings, though that can be very restrictive unless you have really enough people to overcome the traditional restraints that city council rules and the authoritarian policies of the mayor and her police force put upon you when you enter those chambers, or when you try to enter those chambers and find the door locked. In other words, it can be often more effective to show up at events with a large crowd of people and a demand that some actions be taken. If you are persistent and clear and unrelenting in what you do, you can actually sometimes at least get the power to back down slightly, as masses of people did, the demonstrators who marched to city council on February 14th. And demanded that the council allow people who had been abused in the February 13th ICE and SPCD raids on the various communities in our area to speak. What I was looking for from Sandy Brown, I don't, as I said, expect to get anywhere with her or with any of these council members, but it is important that people know what the issues are. And also, council members do have the option to take actions even if they don't have a council majority. That's often the kind of the mask or the excuse that council members use not to take action. But, for instance, I outlined for her 7 things that she could do. And one of those was to request the staff research the specific enforcement provisions that might be included in the sanctuary ordinance. That's the ordinance that says we're a sanctuary city, ICE, immigration control, or immigration customs enforcement, don't come after us. The police are not going to cooperate with you, and if they do, they're going to be held legally liable. That is not currently part of the sanctuary ordinance, as far as I know, and that could be at least researched. And I was suggesting that she find out if, in fact, other cities have done this or it's been proposed in other cities as ways of holding the police department accountable and thereby discouraging them from doing what they did on February 13th, colluding with the immigration attacks. Requested that she make a written request to the mayor that if there is ever an issue involving a large amount of public interest, that it be held, as has been the case in the somewhat distant past now, it be held in a larger venue, a larger building like the Civic Auditorium. That way they have no excuse for locking people out, shutting the doors, lining the walls with cops that then claim means they don't have enough space for ordinary non-uniformed folk. It was done on February 28th. So I asked her to make a specific request to the police department to show her all the correspondence that they had with the Department of Homeland Security or the customs enforcement folks for the last 2 months, And also anything that referenced the ICE-embedded officer in their offices, that is, say, the Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement guy who suddenly Chief Vogel revealed had been there since 2009, which he just, he had known about it, but he assumed that there would be no ICE actions against immigrants around documentation rather than against part of a so-called criminal roundup of people as part of the, what, M13 gang, which is what the subject was of the roundup on February 13th. I attempted to get such documents. I was told there were no documents that were not under investigation. But since the city council has a public safety committee, so-called, headed by, or at least containing, Vice Mayor David Terrazas, she could request of Terrazas that he get these documents and share them with city council members. And as far as I know, she hasn't responded to that yet. I haven't even gotten a peep out of her on that one. I've also requested that she request the DA's report and all witness statements around the Sean Arlt shooting by Officer Eric Bailey back in October, because while the police chief did give his everything's okay report to a closed and selected number of reporters in a locked section of the police station last month, and that was then played as a video later, part of it anyway, we don't have the actual reports of the different witnesses, including both the police witnesses, the drive-along rider, the people inside the house, plus any other video and audio that might not have been mentioned by the chief. That's Chief Vogel, who's retiring in June and who is now being replaced through a committee of people, or actually the committee is going to, I think, advise Martine Bernal, the city manager, who will make the choice rather than actually have any real say in it. It's not entirely clear how much say they will have. Steve Plaich, from his position as vice chair of the ACLU, will be on that board, but and so will Phil Kramer, the head of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. But as far as I'm concerned, no strong advocates for real police control will be there. Steve Plaich has made some suggestions for a police review board. He's expressed concerns to me privately about a lot of these issues, but he seems to be more concerned, and I say this, well, I don't know, I was going to say more in sorrow than in anger, but I'm not happy with it, so it's a little hypocritical for me to claim that I'm just so piously peaceful about the whole thing. I don't like the fact that over the years he has accreted all these board of directors memberships, and yet has taken very little action on his board, and also has kept the boards rather opaque, that is, not transparent to the community when requests are made, and then also sometimes has run meetings. Well, there's a mixed record on that. These were requests to Sandy Brown, a council member, that I made in an email, and I requested she respond as to whether she was going to do any of these things. Again, all she has to do, as far as I'm concerned, is not get the council to make any changes. She hasn't got the votes for that. But to make a request for information in a written form that indicates that she is requesting the information. Then if they turn her down, then it's shame on them. But if she doesn't ask, it's shame on her. I've also requested that she restore the policy of providing at least, and this time in full, all the original claims against the city made by people who are seeking monetary damages from the city for some kind of bad action by the city. And I'm particularly interested, of course, in police abuses and abuses that impact poor and homeless people. But I think that as a matter of general community welfare, if somebody is making a claim against the city and it's going to be considered by the city council, it's a public document. It should be available for the members of the community to see on the city's website before the council meeting in question where that issue is discussed, and the public has some chance to weigh in on it. Seems pretty reasonable to me. But Bren Lehr has refused to do that. In fact, she's now removed the entire claim. At one point, she put the claims up on the city council agenda at my urging, but redacted, that is to say, struck out, removed, covered over, whited out, all contact information for the people making the claims against the city. I know I was damaged by the officer so-and-so at such and such a time, and this, I'm seeking this, and this is what happened. And you might say, well, that's a matter of confidential information. You know, why you don't want to expose a person. Well, the answer is if a person's making a claim against the city, it's public. It's not confidential. What the people who really want it to be confidential are the police department that doesn't want this stuff bruited about and wouldn't like other witnesses to come forward that might testify as to the merits of the lawsuit or at least the claim against the city that's being made. And Bren Lehr, who is... has not been hired by the police department to do this, has merely made a decision that we aren't going to get to see those claims. Well, I'm suggesting to Sandy Brown she make a written request to Bren Lehr to restore those claims in full, including all contact information, so we can contact the people and say, yeah, you know, I saw that incident on Pacific Avenue where they had, you know, eight police officers surrounding one guy who was smoking a cigarette. I saw actually a couple people smoking a cigarette today on Pacific Avenue, but they were middle-class people, and they were outside the Walnut Street Cafe. So, well, I didn't see any cops either at that point, so I can't really say whether they would have been ignored or ticketed or subjected to the three squad cars and four police officers that I saw about a year and a half ago at the same corner going after another two individuals who are a little bit less upper middle class. I also requested to ask for a report on how much money has been spent on enforcement of the sleeping ban on the entire camping ordinance and also the code section that closes the parks after dark. And the reason for this is that in looking over all the citations about a year or two ago, I haven't gotten back to this task and updated it because it's just I haven't had the energy for it, and nobody else has volunteered to come forward. Give me a call if you're interested in helping with this kind of project. I found that almost all the tickets were for those two offenses, camping and so-called sleeping camping, and also for being in a park after dark, which is when people go and try to find a place to sleep somewhere. And rather than expose themselves and invite antagonism by being on the doorsteps of businesses or at residents' homes, they go into a park or into the Poganip, and then they get hassled and harassed by police officers and by rangers. And the question is, what's the cost of this? So I've asked Sandy Brown, you might not be able to get that, but ask for it. Ask for it in a written form. No response from her, at least as of yet. And there are several other things I've also sought, but you get the general idea. I've made this request really clearly to her. I thought I would talk to her about it in person, although there really isn't too much more to say, except, you know, either you're going to do it or you're not. You know, if you need any more information, I can talk to you about it. I mean, I don't have a lot of additional information. I'm seeking information. That's why I make these requests. Anyway, 1 to 3, Friday, Sandy Brown. Call 420-5020 if you want to reach her and leave her a message, but don't hold your breath. Now we return to last Friday, that would be Friday the 17th, when I found that Sandy Brown was not available, even though she said she was going to be. She hadn't replied and let us know she was not going to be available. And I chatted with Dreamcatcher, who also was having problems getting his property back. And he mentioned that, well, you'll hear him talking a bit about it, and then I will have some good news, but also some bad news about that.
His property was taken. What property was that, Dreamcatcher?
Just my trailer with all my property in it.
That included?
Everything.
For example, what would have been in there?
All my bedding. Some food, all my ways of making my living, because I'm a true homeless artist. You know, some tools, everything I have for my trade. I mean, I'm not a bum.
Any medicine?
Yeah, there's medicine in there. There's the antibiotics I need to finish to get rid of the cellulitis, which is about, you know, 5/8 done.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot
ID
better.
Of any kind?
Yeah, there's a DD214 in there of mine and a bunch of tickets with my name on it.
Which I'm eager to see, of course.
Yeah, I got a couple of those right with me now to give you.
I have the largest packet of tickets of any person that I've ever acquired tickets for from you. You've been regularly passing on your Don't Sleep Here tickets.
Yes, I guess they train on me. That could be the CSO driving by right now. The little short lady could have been the one that day. She's pretty by the book type, you know, and I don't mind that, you know. But I wasn't here, so I wasn't able to handle my own situation. I had somebody else in charge of it, and they didn't do it right. So my stuff got confiscated. Now, the ladies down at the property room told me, if they saw me again, it was going to be really difficult for me to get my stuff back, and they're making it that way.
Why would your appearance make it more, well, I think it would be easier if you were there asking.
And if they're familiar with my stuff, it's very easy, you know, to know that everything in that trailer is mine.
Now, this has happened to you before, yeah?
Well, of course it has. That's why I'm having such trouble now. The frequency of me being interpreted as using city property as storage, well, how can stuff in my trailer be considered as reusing city property as storage? Okay, I'm sorry, I have it parked in the wrong place. Well, I'm trying to keep it secure because of all these idiots around here. Well, the idiots are thinning out because that's just the way, you know, the galaxy is going, and I appreciate that in some sense.
Well, I understand that in the past, you've just essentially had to go down during the very limited hours that they do allow you to recall, get your property back, for a total of 4 hours a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 12:30 to 2:30, identified it or said it, what it is, and they got it back to you. How many times did that happen in the past?
Well, every time.
And how many times would you say that was?
At least four.
And was there any problem getting it back in the past?
No, they knew it was mine, and basically when mine got confiscated, a bunch of other people's got confiscated in some type of protest, which was okay. They were all right with that. And I was, you know, helping people to stay calm and to put up with the red tape that you got to go through and not, you know, try to tear down the police department, which a couple of my friends have done without my presence. And
well, they're going to tear it down. Please call me. I want to take pictures.
Well, I have some friends that didn't manage very well, you know,
but the point is that you got your stuff back in the past. There was a procedure they followed.
Right.
It's your property. You have a right to it. It's not lost. It's not abandoned.
Right.
It was confiscated, and you came in using the proper procedures. You picked it up. However, four weeks ago when you tried to do that, what happened?
Every Tuesday and Thursday, I went down there until they told me that, you know, what are you doing here? It's not even your trailer. You know, I go, oh, God dang.
Now, what expert in trailer identification told you that?
The lady at the property room.
Is this the same woman who in the past gave you your property?
Yes.
We know her name.
She wears glasses all the time. She's got dark hair. They both look like sisters. I mean, they're a good property room team. I mean, I got to admit.
They're good at keeping their property from you.
Well, at least keeping it from going to the wrong place. But I'm not the wrong place, and everybody knows this. What do they want, 20 witnesses down there? They said, prove that it's yours. I go, I can identify it.
They're trying.
This is what they've said to me, though.
I believe you. But, you know, the question is, why have they changed their policy?
And then they told
Sandy Brown is sick, so she's not going to be around. Hey, man.
And then they told me to go. And then they told me to go get the ranger. I had two rangers volunteer to help me, and they couldn't believe the story either. Now it's to get the CSO because the rangers just transported.
Maybe
it. They
get the president to come in personally, along with Pat Colby.
You know, I really think our new president would appreciate me with my spirit. Definitely.
Well, I would hope so. You can make Santa Cruz great again by getting your property back.
Well, and being an even better example of what I was in the first place by having a trailer, okay? And if every homeless person got a trailer and could ride off into the sunset and not have to exist under the jurisdiction of the rangers, there are places, you know, you'd never see me again if I didn't get my trailer back.
I think there's a simple way to do it, which is to restrict the jurisdiction of the rangers so they don't come after homeless people, but who am I to say?
Well, they explained their problem to me why they confiscated my stuff, because if anybody else is guarding somebody else's stuff, it turns into a party area and a hazardous waste site.
You are obviously a real hazard. And those sunglasses make me very worried about you. Even without the sunglasses, I'm scared.
Well, I could be scary.
And we're going to get coffee. Because none of those places allow you to have your card in there.
I know, because of the problems that...
The party thing?
So this is Pat Colby, who's joining the conversation. She, too, wanted to speak to Sandy Brown. She has also gone down with Dreamcatcher at different times to try to help him get his property back. Now, without further ado, there is the good news that I mentioned before. I spoke with Abby Samuels before this broadcast. I kind of hoped that we would actually be able to record her because she was really passionate in her outrage about what she discovered. But she did discover... She did, when she went down there after repeated communications with some police department higher-up, I don't know if it was Martinez or some other high police official, she got Dreamcatcher all of his stuff back, but it was ruined because it was kept out in the rain. I found a similar thing some years ago when I went down to claim property. I think it was either for Peace Camp 2010 or the Homies for the Homeless protest in 2007, and it may have been subsequent to that. They apparently just put it out in the backyard. It's kind of similar to what was Mike Rhodes, the Fresno activist, talks about in his book about how, and also in his writings generally, which is his book is a compilation of those writings, about how the Fresno Police Department responded to a successful lawsuit which cost the city $2.3 million and made them promise to a federal judge to stop taking homeless property and throwing it away. Instead, they simply put it in an area where it got soaked and was unusable. And I think they did, there was some subsequent pressure. It was moved to a more distant area, just difficult for homeless people to access. So, I don't know how the police department is handling this. I know that it is completely outrageous, even if they were to return the property promptly after they have, I think, inappropriately taken it in the first place. But it only happens during the two-hour period, Thursday from 12:30 to 2:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And that, the police department is extent of the its amount of the budget. It's kind of like the military nationally. It's a huge chunk of the city's budget, it and the Parks and Rec Department's enforcement arm. So they're being paid a lot of money to essentially torture. Is that the proper word when you steal someone's property, their life-sustaining gear, their clothing, their medicine, their ID? I guess it's maybe it's just a good lesson to encourage them to leave town, not to anger the authorities by expecting the same basic human rights that everyone else in this town should be expecting. Abby noted also that before Dreamcatcher and she were able to pick up his property, they noticed, or perhaps he noticed, I'm not sure which, that they were trying to give his bike away, the property people, to somebody else. And he had to stop them from doing that. He notes he's been trying to get this property back since February 15th. And he also, they didn't really know how much of the property was his, so he took a bunch of it down to City Hall, where there are numerous homeless people, to see if he can determine whose is whose. I suppose, I don't have the details from him directly. I don't know how much of the property that was taken was also that of other people's, and that, you know, he was trying to be the custodian of it, then went away perhaps to go to the bathroom or some such thing. And then when he came back, it was gone. Or there had been some dispute with a ranger, and therefore the ranger got annoyed and decided he would punish the people involved by stealing their stuff and holding it essentially now for more than a month, more like 5 or 6 weeks. I suppose it's good news that Dreamcatcher got back his stuff. It has to be for him, although I don't know how much of it is still usable. But and it's good news that Abby Samuels is able to use her offices, as Pat Colby has at some point in the past, although apparently not in her last foray. She went down with Dreamcatcher a few weeks ago, and reportedly she was completely ignored. I'm going to play a little bit more of this conversation that happened last Friday, and There'll be a lot more of this on the weekend, and I will try to winnow out the less audible portions, and I apologize for that earlier in this broadcast. But let's hear some more while we have time to do it.
No, if at Harvey West, it's when someone lets somebody else watch their blanket and all their stuff, well, they take advantage of somebody else's area.
Let me finish this thing with you, Dreamcatcher, about the issue of, first, you were told you could pick it up, and you did in the past, you did, and you went down there, and they said, no, and tell me if I'm wrong, we need somebody to identify that this is really your property. Can you get a picture of you standing in front of your property?
Only if they give me my property back.
Is that what they told you?
That's what they asked me to
do. They said, we've got your property, go get a picture of you standing in front of your property, but we're not going to let you stand in front of your property.
Yes, they did.
All right. And so the latest story, when you got the Parks and Rec Rangers to say, hey, it's your stuff, it's your property, they said, no, we need the CSO to come down and do it, the community service officer.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct. I tried yesterday, yes, and the paperwork is confidential, so they can't give it to me.
Well, yeah, it is confidential. We can't.
So that might not be entirely clear here. He was told after first get a picture of yourself in front of your property that no, you have to bring in the ranger who took the property to verify that it was your property. So he did. But that wasn't good enough either. There had to also be a CSO, a community service officer, involved. At least this is what I get from his account. In other words, it's my reaction, rather than get more deeply entangled in this, is that they're simply creating one new punishment or barrier after another. It's sort of reminiscent of what happened to Keith McHenry in San Francisco. He was the Food Not Bombs activist who was repeatedly arrested and occasionally beaten, sometimes hospitalized by the police for continuing to staff and organize Food Not Bombs giveaways in front of City Hall in San Francisco and in Golden Gate Park as well over the period from 1988 to 1996 actually. And every time he went for a permit, and they went for a permit I think over 105 times, they would get some different excuse. When they finally did get a permit, the city changed the permit process so that you could no longer get a permit for feeding in the parks. And this is one of the reasons that in Santa Cruz, and I think elsewhere, Food Not Bombs has decided, along with the Occupy movement, that the Constitution is the permit. You don't have to get other permits. If they're asking for them, you simply have to regard that as a form of obstruction and proceed to feed people and to continue to exercise your rights as you're entitled to as a human being and that are somewhat recognized under the Constitution of the United States and of California.
And we found the law.
Top secret.
Right.
He was going to bring it out.
Yeah, and he didn't, after 2 hours, did not bring
right.
it out.
I wrote that to Sandy Brown.
No prints. Clean break.
So, Pat, do you have any thoughts on any of this?
It's just corruption because he's coming up on the 60-day mark.
Yeah.
And they're just, they're not following the procedure. We have the procedure for return of property, and they're just making up rules as they go along.
My DD-214's on there. My veterans, I'm going to get the vet representative down here. If I got to go that far, I don't want to. I just want to get the hell out of here. I got a plan. I'm a vet. I got a house waiting for me, but I want my stuff.
You're just a troublemaker. I can see that. Dreamcatcher. On the upside, we do have.
To clarify, I'm going to play a little bit of this segment again.
Here's this thing with you, Dreamcatcher, about the issue of. First, you were told you could pick it up, and you did in the past, you did. Then you went down there, and they said, no, and tell me if I'm wrong. We need somebody to identify that this is really your property. Can you get a picture of you standing in front of your property?
Only if they give me my property back.
Is that what they told you?
That's what they asked me to do.
They actually said, we've got your property. Go get a picture of you standing in front of your property, but we're not going to let you stand in front of your property.
Yes, they did.
All right. And so the latest story, when you got the Parks and Rec Rangers to say, hey, it's your stuff, it's your property, they said, no, we need the CSO to come down and do it, the community service officer.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct. I tried yesterday, yes, and the paperwork is confidential, so they can't give it to me.
Well, yeah, it is confidential. We can't.
And we sat in the lobby.
Top secret.
Right.
And he was going to bring it out.
Yeah, and he didn't, after 2 hours, did not bring
right.
it out.
So, at least as of a week ago, the additional barrier was they wouldn't even let him see the appropriate papers involved around his property. Maybe because they didn't have any papers. I don't know. But let's hear some more and take deep breaths.
You're just a troublemaker. I can see that.
I can
catch
you.
You know, on the upside, we do have the fact that for the last 3 nights there have been sleepouts here in front of City Hall. Normally it happens once a week, but it happened last night, Thursday night, and the night before. And I've just heard from Sea Otter, that he will be volunteering to cook every night here if he can get the cooking implements from Food Not Bombs to do it. So,
and actually now that we are going on Thursday the 23rd, or in the middle of Thursday the 23rd, that means that there have been sleepouts for the last 10 days, or 9 days, 9 or 10 nights at City Hall. Two of them have been official freedom sleepouts, 88 and 89, but the rest of them were organized by homeless people themselves, or organizers, when you write the word. They had to take that action, and they did, or they chose to take that action and to, in essence, say, we've got no legal place to go. I actually have done a lot of interviewing around that, almost all of which I will not be able to play today because of time limitations, but I will subsequently play it, and that'll be on Sunday, so come on back then. We're going to hear a bit more, and then we're going to segue you into Uncle Dennis's show, From the Cream to the Dregs.
I was hoping he would do that. I was just thinking about that, seeing if he would do that. That's great.
Pat, any comments? A lot of police cars driving by. Maybe
they just stopped, lost the intersection there, and stared at us.
Oh, well, that's okay. You know, we are rather attractive people. It's true.
I think it's you in that tight T-shirt.
Indeed, I cut quite a figure. I know that you have an admirer here who wants to talk to you, Dreamcatcher. Mm-hmm. Pat, anything else you want to say?
I didn't know that all the other stuff. Thank you for bringing me up to date on all the other games that they've been playing on you.
Anything you'd like to say for free radio?
And it's good that if you have a place to
go. I would like to say for this community, keep the faith going.
And we've been talking with
Ocean Folk.
Thank you, man. So I'm talking with
Sea Otter.
And Sea Otter, you cooked for a long time for Food Not Bombs, then you cooked for a different meal.
A few other meals, yeah.
And you're a qualified cook, and now you're ready to cook again, right?
Yes, yes.
What is leading you back to this kitchen obsession? Why are you such a kitchen fanatic there?
It's in my blood.
And so, what kind of meals do you anticipate will be coming if you get the cooking implements you need?
A healthy vegan meal, yeah.
And what's your reaction to the Freedom Sleepouts and this upcoming homeless-initiated nightly Freedom Sleepout?
I think it's really groovy. The evening sleepout every night. I'm willing to cook for them. Yeah.
How is
it's in my heart to do that. Yeah,
yeah I'm
I think as of, well, I haven't heard that Sea Otter has been able to secure from Food Not Bombs the cooking implements he needs, which is too bad. I think there was a falling out between them at some point in the past, and that hasn't been remedied yet. Food Not Bombs, get it together. Although I understand Food Not Bombs values its cooking implements because they do regularly serve over 100 people at the Friday and Saturday and Sunday meals and the Tuesday Freedom Sleepout. But I think this action happening nightly at the City Hall and essentially attended by homeless people themselves without the wise guidance of their betters from the housed community is a good thing and an important thing and a thing to be supported. Encourage people to go down there, provide food, blankets, sleeping bags, whatever they can. And be advised, however, that, you know, full disclosure, this is a homeless encampment. There's drug use. It can be rough at times. It can be loud. People are not excluded if they're drunk. It's sort of self-managing in the sense that I don't even know how they're managing it, but and I guess get sort of anecdotal stories afterward. But it is, for I think most of the folks, although perhaps certainly not all, but those who choose to go there, probably a much safer place to be than in a distant place where they are not around other people. We'll see if that is in fact the case in the days ahead.
Since I'm one of them.
Yeah, you yourself are outside.
Yeah.
How long have you been an outsider?
5-6 years.
And here in Santa Cruz?
Yes. Yes.
And how has it changed, if at all, if it or has it?
A little more harassment from the Rangers.
Have you gotten tickets yourself?
In front of City Hall, it seems like not a problem of getting any tickets as long as you have some type of signage on what you're like protesting.
This is a protest kind of sign.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything that's happened in the last week you want to pass on?
A lot of people have asked me to think about cooking for Food Not Bombs in the last month, and it took some discernment, and I decided, yeah, that's their need and my need to,
your need
keep
to serve
cooking.
Their need to be served.
Yes, so, yes.
Their hunger and your hunger to provide.
Yes.
Well, you mad fool, you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We've been talking with
Sea Otter.
Sea Otter.
Yes.
So also on are in and headlining and front paging this week's Good Times is a picture of Brent Adams, who is sometime guest on this show, a activist for a number of causes, and most relevantly and recently, the Warming Center, which he's been able to keep open for about 2 weeks, different points during the winter, and which gets some positive coverage in this issue of the Good Times. He gets positive coverage, too. Usually he gets smeared as a former Santa Cruz 11 criminal who occupied 75 River Street and along with 10 other people, myself included, who were dragged into court for essentially politically motivated charges, what, 5 years ago now, in a whole series of prosecutions that seriously cooled down and froze out the protest movement in Santa Cruz, if not crushing it entirely, in essence. I haven't heard much activity against the banks and much organizing, although there has been a renewal of organizing for rent control, and good for those folks. Some of us have held on and continued to be active, but there's been a real clamping down and intimidation of activists. But Brent has gotten the NEXTY Award, I believe, for Nonprofit of the Year for the Warming Center, and the issue gets some coverage in the Good Times. I don't know if it's, I've looked over the article briefly, maybe I'll be talking about it more. It contrasts the Warming Center and its occasional but positive contributions of a limited sort with the nightly but still very limited and rather restrictive contributions of the Association of Faith Communities Winter Shelter Program, which really nobody seems too happy about, really, although they say, well, better than nothing, and it's only the beginning, and these are the first steps, and yada, 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 the usual stuff. It's worth looking at. I encourage people to take a look at it. I got a call from a critic of Brent Adams who didn't want to, who wanted to, thought it was horrible that he got the front page coverage, and I think, no.